Hey, this is Andrew. I'm the Executive Director of Literary Arts and also the host of the Archive Project. Here at Literary Arts, we're at our year-end campaign, and so much of our programming here online or out in the community, things like Wordstock, are accessible or low cost. We can do that because people like you give. You can help keep us accessible for our whole community by making a gift today at literary-arts.org. And thank you. Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. Find these and more at colehaan.com. In this episode, we hear from journalist and best-selling writer of nonfiction, Ta-Nehisi Coates. In 2015, Coates' second book, Between the World and Me, was published. It won the National Book Award that same year and went on to be a New York Times bestseller for more than 80 weeks. On the surface, this is improbable, as this slim volume is in the form of a letter to the author's son, hardly a popular form, and Coates was not a household name at the time. Also, the book speaks about African-American experience in ways so searing and painful that many readers felt the need to put the book down while at the same time felt compelled to finish it. And indeed, millions of Americans have read this book. I would argue it's one of the greatest works of nonfiction of our era because of the artistry and honesty of the prose. It is bluntly powerful and tender at the same time. Toni Morrison called it required reading and said Coates was the heir to James Baldwin. Coates is a national correspondent at The Atlantic and the author of three books, the most recent of which is entitled We Were 8 Years in Power, An American Tragedy, which is a collection of his journalism. He was in Portland to discuss this book with Jenna Wortham from the New York Times as part of Wordstock, Portland's book festival, in 2017. And in this conversation, Coates displays all of the brilliance, insight, honesty, and empathy contained in his writing. Here's Coates and Wortham.
Thank you, guys. This is also the last stop on Ta-Nehisi's book tour, which feels really special to me.
Yes. I'm so tired of y'all.
So your life is so different now than it was a few years ago, and the world is really different from when you started out as a thinker and a critical, you know, or public intellectual. How are you staying sane? I saw on Twitter you had this great thing the other day. It was like, time to sage the mentions, let's talk about Dungeons and Dragons. And I was like, really? But I thought that was amazing. And that you do have these like bloodletting mechanisms to help you cope with everything. But let's talk about that for a little bit.
Yeah, it was just one of those days with you. I can't remember what we were talking about the day before. It was either Roy Moore or John Kelly or something. And it wasn't even like my mentions were bad. It was just like people who were just filled with just complete frustration. I was like, I can't go look and it'd be like this. So, you know, you just switch the topic and you say, hey, I'll answer any question you have about Dungeons and Dragons. Let's go.
It went on for a while, though.
It did. And then I left and it was still going like 10 hours later. It might still be going, actually. It might still be there, people there talking about it. But usually, actually, what I do, Jenna, is when, like, I'm underground and writing something, I block that out. I can't really, you know, be like in constant conversation in that way on Twitter. And then I come back when it's all done and, you know, it's time for promotion and everything. But I think, honestly, I think a lot about professional athletes and entertainers. I think about like Kanye West, and I used to be like, what is the matter with Kanye? Why can't Kanye get it together? Why can't Kanye, he's so talented, he's clearly a genius, why can't... I understand. I get it. Nobody should ever talk bad about Kanye West. Because I think I got about 0.00005% of what Kanye got. And I had a relatively stable family. I had a, you know, beautiful wife who I've been with for 19 years. I had a, you know, a kid, you know, who was, you know, sharp and on point, and I almost went crazy, so. You know, I get it a lot more. I am awed now by people, athletes, entertainers who at a relatively young age get a lot dumped on them. Mm-hmm. you know, and it's good, it's nice, you know what I mean? But it's a ton of pressure. I have no idea what they do. I have no idea, like, how LeBron James is LeBron James. I don't understand it, actually. Because I would have, like, 15 kids by now if I was LeBron. I mean, it would be something. I would have just, you know what I'm saying? I would have fell in love with every woman I saw. I mean, it just would have been, you know, I mean, I don't know. It would have been bad, whatever it would have. It just wouldn't have been good.
What's the pressure that you feel?
I think what happened was, like, before Between the World and Me, I felt like a writer, by which I mean, you know, I went and, you know, thought about things and things I was interested in, I went and wrote about. And that was it. And then after Between the World and Me, or really just before Between the World and Me, and then after, it became like you have the answer to everything, or you should have the answer to everything, which I was always firmly against. Like, I always thought, like, the coolest thing about our jobs as journalists was what you're curious about, you get to choose, and then you get to go answer. Which is different than, you know, as you just said, you know, like this phrase you used earlier, public intellectual, where it's thought that you should have something smart to say about everything. You know what I mean? Like everything, like everything. Like you gotta go be able to go from the environment to feminism to, you know, international, like all of these things people bring to you. And it's like, I don't even, like, you know what I mean? Like, even within black shit, like, I got my lane within that.
You're not, well, people treat you like you're Negronomous, basically.
Right, yeah, and I'm not Negronomous at all. I got, like, this lane. I know what I've read and what I've reported and what I've researched, but there's a lot that's way, way beyond that. But I think, like, there's this cult of smartness, and people perceive you as smart on one thing. And that means you're smart on everything. And there are people, I think, in the world who have promoted themselves in that way and, you know, made a decent living promoting themselves that way. And, you know, like, there are consequences, you know? Like, the idea of being smart, like, it obscures the actual work. It obscures the fact of actually, like, reading. It obscures the reporting of going to talk to people. People think you sit down and, you know, you're a MacArthur genius. You sit down, the words come to you, and then that's it, you know, and then you go have a drink. That's not how it works. That's not how it works, but people, you know, sort of perceive it that way.
And the stakes are higher, too, I think, for public-facing black people.
Right.
The stakes are just higher.
Right.
If you are, not that anyone would expect you to do this, but that people coming to you and saying, weighing on this thing, expect you to speak from a point of totality of blackness.
Right, right. And so, like, on one level, like, you, I think it's important to reject that. because my answer to that has always been, listen, what we want is to remove the whole, you know, HNIC thing. Like, we want that. Like, don't give me a crown, dude. Like, we don't want that. We have, especially right now, I mean, we got enough people that's not really necessary. Like, you're asking me to speak over here, but actually it's people that can do it.
Yeah.
And can do it really, really well and are fully, you know, capable. So it's not even like a lack of a talent. The flip side of that, though, is I do, in some respects, like when black folks expect you to represent, like, I get that. Mm-hmm. I get that. And I think about that a lot. I think about representing well. I think about acquitting myself well. I think about not embarrassing black people a lot. maybe more than that's healthy. But I do. You know,
done a great job. So
thank you. Thank you.
I'm here to tell you.
I'm trying.
We're
thank
proud
you.
Of you.
Thank you. Thank you. That means something. That means something. I went through it. You know, I was telling Jenna, like, I went through it today because I wore a suit for every stop. And this was the last stop. And I was like, you know what? I'm putting on my hoodie, my Air Max ones. I'm just going to go out there. But it's like, I don't want to embarrass anybody. You know what I'm saying? Like, I talk about respectability policies, but really in the back of my head, it's like you're trying to be respectable, you know, in a certain way at least.
But do you think that interest in finding the HNIC, as you put it, comes from a point in American culture where we are so lost and there is this existentialism about we don't know where to look, we don't know how to make sense of this moment, which is actually not just this moment, but as you point out in the book, which we'll get to in a second, you know, it actually expands a continuum. Or is that a product of just our media cycle and the way we think about how we consume people and how we want them to, what role we want them to perform for us?
You know what, John, I think in some way it's like an interpretation of the tradition. Like, there's this idea, and I don't know how true that would have been if you were in the moment. But there's this idea that there are people who, you know, speak on behalf of black people. And, you know, at any one moment, it's one person who, you know what I mean, is the light. Again, I don't know if it looked like that contemporaneously if you were in that moment. And so people expect that. You know, I would never complain about, like, the praise Toni Morrison, you know, gave me in terms of Baldwin. In fact, you know, I've, you know, said very, very directly that when I was writing, I was thinking about that. But people hear that, and they don't hear, like, literally you're thinking about the writing. They think about the image of Baldwin. Like, they think about what Baldwin means in the imagination. Not Baldwin as a writer, but what, like, Baldwin almost as a spook, a ghost, a phantom, a spirit. You know, and they think about you assuming that. You know what I mean? They don't think, I'm trying to write. Like physically, like the physical act of writing. You know, the very concrete thing. And so I just think, in people's mind, is this tradition. You know, and one of the, Jenna and I on an email list together, and one of the beautiful things about it, it's a bunch of black writers on that list.
You can't give it all away. I'm just kidding. Reveal the secrets of black
that?
Illuminati.
Sorry, we're supposed to say that.
It exists, it's real.
Yeah. It's a ton of talent on that list. There's somebody else on there. I won't say who it is now that you said that. I won't say who else is on there. But I was just talking about somebody else who was on there to Jenna. I was saying, this dude scares me. Like, he's so good, it's scary. You know what I mean? Like, his eyes, like, I read it, I'm like, oof. And not black good. Like, not, you know, good within the ranks of black. Like, this dude is good. Like, good. You know what I mean? And so you think, like, damn. You know what I mean? There's so much talent at this particular moment. And so many people that are, you know, working really, really hard that you want, like, that to be recognized. Like, I feel like I got community. Like, I got people. And you want the people to get, you know what I'm saying? Like the light, you know what I'm saying? Because the reasons why certain particular ones of us get it at the particular time, I maintain, are not necessarily always related to the quality of work we're doing. You understand? Now, I'm fully confident what I'm doing. I think it's great. I think there's a lot of other great people doing great work, too, you know? Mm-hmm.
So how do you manage other people's expectations of you? And I'm thinking specifically, there's a word that comes up a lot in your current collection, which is exonerate, and the interest in self-exoneration. I'm speaking specifically about liberal white people who want to exonerate themselves and who say, like, I saw Get Out, but I'm on the good side. I'm not on that side of Get Out. When it's like, no, you're everyone in that movie, actually. But, right? I mean, that's the point of the movie. But I feel like, you know, you are public facing, and not just in the sense that you're on Twitter and you're on TV, but you're here and people interact with you and you're out in the world and people know who you are, which is unusual for someone to have that amount of visibility and I guess fame, however we're gonna use that word. And be living and accessible. And so what is it like for you when people, readers, white people are like on the train to you, just like, I'm sorry. I mean, does that happen or what do you do?
It happens. Always thank you, but it's a different thank you than I get from black people. It's not a wrong thank you, but it is different. With black people, it's like, thank you. Like, I've been trying to tell these you know what I mean? You tell them, yo, I just came in the door and the cat at the door, he was like, you keep telling them. So you keep telling them, thank you, keep telling them. You know, white people was like, thank you. You know what I mean? It's a different thank you. But you know what? It's not a wrong thank you. It's not a wrong thank you. It's not here's what I'll say, and we were talking about this on the way over. I think before what people are terming as the Weinstein effect, I was much less compassionate about it. And I was talking to some brothers when this, you know, when these names first started coming out. And I said to them, I said, do you guys feel like this tremendous sense of guilt? And they said, yes. Everybody was like, yes, yes, I feel that. And it wasn't that any of them had did anything, you know, in the sort of, you know, direction of, you know, what was being accused of. But, and then I said, do you feel, I mean, this is where the conversation went. It wasn't this clean, but this is where it went. Do you feel like this overwhelming urge to say, not me, not me? not all men. Like, actually feel that. You know, like, it's a mockery, but you know what I mean? Like, actually, and they were like, yeah, I do. And so I get it. You know what it is? It's like, because I had to think about this. You may not have done what Harvey Weinstein did. You may not have done what Leon Wieseltier did. You may not have done what Louis C.K., James Toback, 300 women, my God. But anyway, I mean, we can get into that in a second. You might not have done that, but you begin to think about all the small things that you do get to do. My wife is in a nice hotel in LA. She's having a girls' trip, right? Her and her friends. So they're partying, having a good time, joking. It's 3 a.m, somebody knocks on the door, right? She thinks it's a noise complaint. She looks out, it's a dude. And the dude is like, I heard y'all, and I just wanted to know if y'all wanted to have some company. But she was like, yo, this was so creepy, and this is what it means. Like, this would never happen to you and your friends. If y'all were partying, nobody is knocking on the door at 3 a.m. like that, in that sort of creepy way. You think about all of the small privileges like that you enjoy, and there are others. And you realize how you're connected. Do you understand? Like, it don't matter that you didn't do X, Y, and Z. You know what I mean? Just as much as it don't matter that this woman didn't ask to be harassed. That my wife did not ask for some creepy dude to knock on the door at 3 a.m., right? Like, you're connected to it. That's the feeling you feel, and you feel guilty. The power, like, when you can see it in that way, you feel guilty. And so, like, white guilt is a thing that people mock now, white guilt, ha-ha, but it really is the guilt of power. You understand? And recognizing that power is being used in an unjust way. And you're part of it. So, I mean, I don't want people coming up to me asking for forgiveness. Like, because one of the things we decided was, like, we were talking, well, you know, I had this urge to say, you know, but one of the things was like, okay, I probably should not be tweeting about this. I probably shouldn't be talking about this. You know what I mean? Unless it's to, you know, amplify somebody else, but don't nobody need my commentary. Like, here's what I think, God. Nobody don't need that. It's not your time, man. It's not your time. Just, you know what I mean? Back up, listen, take a second. You know what I mean? Take a second. But honestly, a lot of that was thinking about all of the white reaction I had gotten, you know what I mean, and processing it. So, I mean, it has made me a lot more sympathetic, actually.
Mm-hmm. It's one good thing.
One good thing.
Out of all this.
Out of all of this, right? One very, very minor.
Well, I do want to talk specifically about your book, because I'm sorry, because I know I've listened to a couple of interviews you've done about this book, and I know everyone asks you to talk about the title. So I'm sorry to ask you to do it again. But I also find, you're such a student of history. You're such a history nerd, which is a delightful thing in being your friend that I've come to find out about you. Like, you really are a nerd about history. But it is so important to, I mean, we're not really taught as Americans, and I mean, as people alive in 2017, to live in the past. We live in the present. We live for what we want to accumulate. We live for what's coming next. We're not really taught to look back. And there's a lot of danger in that. And I think, I like the story about where the title comes from, because it is trying to place in a very specific context an understanding of not just how we got here, but why this is not surprising and inevitable.
It's so funny, when people see that title, they think, like, we were 8 years in power. Like, I'm saying black people were in power for 8 years, but I meant it in a much more, one might say, dubious, at least ambivalent way of thinking about the world. So it comes from this congressman by the name of Thomas Miller. Thomas Miller was a, God, I've been in tour so long, I hope I'm saying his name right. I have the sneaking suspicion that I'm not. So forgive me if I'm not. congressman from South Carolina during Reconstruction, literally was 8 years, you know, as a congressman. This is the first class of African-Americans who are in power throughout the South. And basically what they came together, you know, with some other white folks and formed these interracial governments all throughout the South. A lot of these guys was like right out of slavery. Like literally you was like enslaved the year before, the next year you are sitting in, you know, Congress. Somebody like Robert Smalls, for instance, you know what I mean, who was literally enslaved and then finds himself in Congress. And this went on for a period of 8 years, and then, you know, it was basically, you know, shut down. Officially, though one might argue the shutdown went before that, in 1876, after you get the, you know, the compromise of 1877 with the presidential election. 1895, South Carolina decides to finalize its effort to disenfranchise black people in South Carolina. And this is going on all through the South. And our congressman from South Carolina, like, he can't understand why these folks want to do this. And he makes this, you know, speech at the South Carolina Constitutional Convention that year. He says, listen, we were 8 years in power. And during that time, you know, we established a prison system. We established a school system. We established, you know, institutions for the insane, as they would have called it at that time. We basically built this state, man. We reconstructed the state of South Carolina. It was nothing, you know, here. We took this from, you know, the brink of war and ravages and gave you guys a state. And now you guys want to cut us out? Why would you do this? We were good. We were good stewards of citizenship. And W.E.B. Du Bois, in his great book, Black Reconstruction, some 40 years or so later, is observing this. And he says that Congressman Miller's great problem was that he did not understand. He thought that what he needed to do was to appeal to the good sense and the good intelligence of white South Carolinians and point out that black folks had actually, you know, furnished what he called, what Du Bois called, good Negro government. They had been good stewards of the citizenship and the vote and everything. And Du Bois says what he did not understand was what white South Carolina feared more than bad Negro government was good Negro government. It was a good Negro government that they were afraid of. Because had these folks gotten into, you know, Congress and into the legislature and acted as they were depicted, say, in a film like Birth of a Nation, you know, acted a fool, you know, basically verified all the stereotypes that make white supremacy work, that would have been fine. That would have proved the point. The threat was that they did not prove the point. The threat was that by their very presence, they, you know, furnished themselves as a tool of anti-racist propaganda. That was the threat for what was then white minority rule. In fact, the majority of people in South Carolina were black. Forgive me, I'm just going a little long. I'm getting to it, though.
Take your time.
Okay, all right.
That's good.
Thanks. So you see examples of this all through, like, American history. And the one I, you know, talk about in the introduction and immediately always comes to mind is, like, towards the end of the Civil War. The white South decides it wants to, for instance, arm black troops to fight for slavery, in fact. That was an idea that they actually had. How did they get that idea? Because they were firmly against it before. Well, I mean, the Union had armed 200,000 African Americans to fight, and these folks, again, you know, they furnished, you know, quite a bit of anti-racist propaganda. They fought, lo and behold, like anybody else fought in that day. And as the proposal was going through, this guy from Georgia, Hal Cobb, he says, you know, you can't make soldiers of Negroes, of slaves. For if you can make soldiers of slaves, then our whole theory of slavery is wrong. In other words, if these dudes fight for us successfully, then what were we fighting for exactly? Even if we win, we lose. And that's a trend all through American history. When you have, if you look at the riots, the pattern of riots in this country, or the pattern of really racist pogroms in the first half of the 20th century, what you see is, what are the first thing? They burn down the churches. They burn down the businesses. They burned down the schools. They burned down the very institutions of responsibility and uplift. So you get to the point where, you know, you are here and you have your first African-American president. Many, many years after, you know, Thomas Miller's declaration, who, I don't know if there's been a more shining emblem in American history of good Negro government than Barack Obama. You have this guy, right? I mean, this dude, you know, goes to Harvard Law School, graduate of Columbia, wife Ivy League educated, so that, you know, basically the best educational, highest educational institutions in this country. Two beautiful daughters, dog named Bo. Got the whole, I mean, this is the package, man. If you wanted an emissary of us to you, this is the best we got, man. This is the best we got. Got white family. Raised by white people. I mean, got white family. You know, it don't really get any better than this. It's the best we got. What is the greeting that this representative of good Negro government gets? Half the majority, depending on when you take the poll, the opposition party says this dude is not a legitimate president. He's a Kenyan. A Kenyan. Furnished proof that he's not. Reduced to the fact actually having to furnish your birth certificate, this has no effect on people's actual belief. He tries to represent himself well, clean, acquit himself well, and they hate him for it. They hate him. They hate the fact that he actually, you know, is, you know, this walking embodiment of everything that they say black people aren't. And so the theory in a lot of black folks' circle is if we make ourselves respectable to them, then, you know, maybe that will ameliorate the hatred, but they have it wrong. They hate you because you're respectable. It's the respectableness that inspires the hate. Because you undercut by your very example. And so not only do they, do folks say you are not a legitimate president, you get a guy who has never served in politics in his life, never served in the military. First time in American history, somebody is allowed to rise this far. And what does he power his presidential run on? The fact that you are completely illegitimate. The hatred of you, still running against you even as president to this day. And so it just shows you, you know, how powerful this idea, you know, goes. And so when I looked and saw the parallel between those two, between that, like the tragedy of being able to say, look, you know, we're decent people. We take care of our kids. We're capable of achieving and being as respectable as you. And the amount of hate that actually inspires in the moment, you know, it was powerful to me. And that's the reason also for the subtitle, for the, you know, the American tragedy part of it.
I keep bringing up mental health and coping mechanisms because I do think there, and you know, we're a year in, it feels like it could have been a decade, but it's only been a year. But there's a way in which that moment of reckoning, which, and thank you for explaining so much, because I think that's really powerful, but I think there's a moment of reckoning of, you know, this time last year when we were faced with that, that confrontation. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, even when we do everything we're supposed to do, it's not enough. And actually it's gonna inflame these racist ideas and continue. It's not really racial progress, it's racist progress, you know, that's been reignited or ignited. And the confrontation of that, at least for me personally, has been devastating. Mm. And so I think this is what I'm trying to ask you in a way, which is, and I'm really invested in thinking about ideas of self-care and not in the hashtag treat yourself kind of way, although that is valid too, but what it means when you think about caring for yourself amid that, because you write in your book, you say, you know, that you were lulled, I mean, a lot of us were, into this, that the Obama years granted us this leniency,
right,
that maybe we were gonna be okay.
Right.
Maybe one
right.
day we would be loved, and I'm still really thinking a lot about the aftermath of that. Hasn't caught up to us yet, I don't think.
So were you surprised by the, like, were you like, my God, did you have one of those moments? Like, were you surprised when Trump won?
Yeah, I was.
So I always say I was shocked, but not surprised. I didn't mm-hmm. think he was gonna win, but I didn't
I
put it past
that.
These
yeah.
folks. I just didn't. They're yeah. fully capable of making Donald Trump president.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? So it was sort of, yes, I mean, I don't want to minimize my own, you know, I didn't think it would happen. But most of the reasons why I actually didn't think it was going to happen, Jenna, was out of a sense of, and I don't know how else to put this, white self-preservation. Like, I thought folks would be able to say, oh, this is clearly not in my interest mm-hmm. to have this dude negotiate with North Korea. Like, it's just not, that shouldn't happen. Like, I don't like Obama, you know what I mean? He was all right. I really, really don't like Hillary, but I just, I can't, you know what
it's
I mean?
Too
I
crazy.
It's too crazy.
Yeah.
It's just too, that's just too far. Even like, you know, when the tape came out, I thought, and you know, there are problems with diagnosing things in this way, definitely. You know what I mean? So I don't want to say I'm endorsing this, but I thought the psychology would be, he could be talking about my daughter, my sister, so I can't go that far.
Mm-hmm.
Turned out not to be true. So I think if anything, like what it did for me, like it was like, it reinforced the power of this piece. People don't understand, like everything that you are terrified by at this moment, everything, this seems like it's not related to the history of racism and white supremacy, actually is. Because without it, he just couldn't be president. I mean, there are like a bunch of ways to approach that, right? The first most obvious way is you show me a black dude who could have never held political office in his life, who could never have served in, you know, the military, who could be caught on tape bragging about sexual assault of a white woman, who could just say of a judge, you know, he's a Mexican, he can't judge, and let's flip it, let's make it what it would be for somebody black. He's a Jew, he can't judge my case. Mm-hmm. You know, something that, you know, sort of provocative, and then become president. It's just not possible. And, you know, given, you know, and I have to say this, given who he was running against, you can't imagine a woman doing that. Mm-hmm. You can't imagine Hillary Clinton, like, having all of those demerits and then becoming president. You understand? And so you think, this piece is powerful. Mm-hmm. Like, it's really powerful, you know?
When we talk about something like white supremacy, we actually, our job in some ways has become clear in the last year. Right. We have to look at what that means on a very specific basis, resegregation, gerrymandering, wealth inequality, and try to break it down. And I mean, you've done this in your work too, but you know, just to sort of try to really talk about what we mean when we say white supremacy. But why is it so hard for people to accept that this is a thing? I mean, this is,
because they make money off of it. It's the same, listen, if you, And more than money is just a representation of privilege. I got to take it back to me because I think it's a human condition. I say white, but again, by white, I do not mean, you know, light skin, blonde hair, blue eyes, European ancestry. I mean the notion that, you know, those things should accord you some sort of privilege. My way, again, I mean, this has been very educational, understanding this. If you had told me about Harvey Weinstein, I believe that. If you had told me, you know, listen, sexual harassment is a big problem, you know, in the workplace, I'd have said, yeah, that seems about right. But when you see it clearly, it's just a different, you know, response. And I think it works the same way for race. Do you understand? Like, I think, like, most of my readers, you said, you know, race is a big problem in this country. They say, yeah, it is. I mean, most of the folks that read what I do, they would say, yeah, it is. But when you show them, you know, as I said, the receipts, like when you outline it, they say, my God, my God. Like, I understood it abstractly, but I didn't really get it. You know what I mean? Like, and again, this should not be the standard, but it's very hard, A, when you're not the person who's part of the class that it's happening to, and B, I mean, let's be real about this. When you, in some way, no matter how passively, benefit from the actual system, it's hard. Ain't too many John Browns. You know what I mean? For anything. It just ain't that many. Whenever you're in like a system, and I want to, you know, like put stress on that word, that is plundering somebody else and giving power to a group, and you're part of the group that's getting the power, it's a lot of work to extract yourself and see clearly. Mm-hmm. Like, it's hard. It's really, really, even if you have goodwill, it's just difficult, man. I mean, you're making money off of this. You're getting things out of it. Mm-hmm. Who are you in this? Like, you go through, okay, so who am I in this structure now? No, it's a lot of work.
I just realized, though, you still didn't answer my question about self-care. So that's okay.
All right.
I'm gonna
I can answer that. No, I don't want to be ducking.
It's okay. I was just gonna say. I mean, I'm happy to book massages for you in Kenyatta and LA if you want. I want to make sure you guys are
self-care. The answer I have been giving whenever I ask about is that the writing is the self-care for me. That the writing actually makes me happy. But yeah, I think that's not. Let me tell you why I think that's not legit.
Writing is misery. I mean,
yeah, but don't you feel good to like get it out? Like you feel a certain way, and it's like
after all the tears and all the seamless.
Yeah. I mean, because I think like what's worse is to be kind of sealed off and to have to carry, you know, like how you feel about the world. Having said that, when I was in LA, I got this text, you know, and it was like, you can't do anything between this hour and this hour. Just show up in this place. And Kenyatta, my wife, had booked a massage. And that's not a bad thing.
Yeah.
I will confess I felt a little different.
Yeah.
I will confess that I walked out, it was a little high. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And then texted a buddy of mine, a homeboy who don't get massages. I was like, yo, get a massage. You need to get a massage.
I like that. I really like that. That's good. So I was revisiting the collection, We Were 8 Years in Power, which is a combination of some of the work you previously published and then intros, new intros into that. And I think what impressed me about the way the book is put together, it's very well done. And what I liked about it is you do kind of confront your previous self and you look at some of the your own optimism or, I guess, absence of optimism, your old anger, the way you want to be a custodian of history and the things you want to show people. Like, you can't look away from this thing about racism and I want to show it to you. But in the book, it's great because you sometimes you write these intros and you almost write, you know, in the intro to the essay about Bill Cosby, you sort of tackle some of the things you didn't address in the essay. Same with the case reparations. And I don't know, I want to commend you for that because a lot of writers don't look back and say, oh, I could have done things differently slash better slash here's what I would have put in or taken out, which is a big undertaking. But I want to know, how did that feel and what did it, was it hard to do?
No.
Good.
No, it wasn't hard to do. I think the difference for people like us is if you, and I'm a little older, so I had a journalism career before like the internet and before social media, but I got on through blogging. And if you're blogging, you're kind of always in process, and it habituates you. Like, you just can't always be right. And blogging is not that big now, but at the time, people didn't really want to read somebody. I mean, you can't really do that sort of free form and act right, because then you're just replicating something over here. You're not actually doing anything new. So I think that starting with blogging helped a lot. Because, you know, I said, oh, I wrote this yesterday, that was wrong. And it wasn't a big thing. Also, you know what, Jenna? I think like a lot of writers feel like their credibility is rooted in being right. And I don't think that's what people expect of me. I think they expect me to be honest. Or at least try to be. And those are two different things, right? Like, you ain't gotta be right all the time, but you gotta be sincere. And then, you know, when you're obviously wrong, you can't, like, just stand up there and be Nicodemus. And I don't want that, man. I mean, that is anti to me all of the great things about journalism and about writing. You know, chief, you know, among all of those is curiosity. You know, and when you're pursuing your curiosity, you know, you're gonna be wrong. I mean, writing for me is learning. It's the acquisition of knowledge. That's the best part, not the performative part. It's the acquiring. And now I know something I didn't know before. Now I got a different way, you know, of thinking about the world. But that's the cool part. It's the thinking your way through it. You know what I mean? And I just feel like the writing is just that, you know, over a long period of time. Just because I published a piece, it don't mean the thinking is over. You know, you keep thinking about it, you keep turning it over.
But the culture of social media is not one of editing. I mean, we sort of, everyone is trying to come out on the right side of, you know, ahead of the curve, one up each other, you know, so it's kind of interesting to, for me, it was interesting to sort of read a book that's sort of, I guess, dealing with the unreality of that situation.
That's interesting. I guess you are right. But then it kind of looks stupid. You can't tweet and be right all the time. I mean,
no.
Who can do that?
Don't tweet. I mean, you can't tweet
right.
and be right.
You
it's
can't
not
be
the
tweet
point.
And be right. I mean, you don't. I mean, you can't. I mean, you can't. Yeah, so. But you are right. But people try to do that. You're very, very correct. Even despite that, they try to act like they are. You're right.
I did notice in the book that you, in the, I guess that's notes, maybe notes from the 6th year or the 7th year. I can't remember now, but one of the notes from one of the years, in the essay right before My President Was Black, you talk about how for that essay, you did have to go quiet and you did have to go offline and that you didn't work as publicly as you had before. And I'm just curious about how your writing process has changed over your career.
So I was thinking about this the other day because you go through it with social media, you know, and you think about, like, I think like the simplest thing to say is, I'm not interacting at all. I ain't tweeting, I'm out. And I've been there, right? Like, I've been there and thought about that and done that and, you know, rage quitted and, you know, all of that good stuff. But I think what you need to do is make the tool work for you. Mm-hmm. Like, I think you need to figure it out. Like, it's pretty clear. I mean, I had these folks run these diagnostics at one point when this book was coming out, and they literally looked at, like, who my biggest followers were, who were quote-unquote super followers, and like how I actually looked at how people got to articles. And they figured out that actually when I even though, for instance, The Atlantic has more followers, when I tweet something out, like, for some reason, people feel more intense about it. Like, they're more likely to feel, okay, this must be legit. And I thought, well, okay, you don't want to get rid of that. But you do need to figure out how to live with it. Mm-hmm. Like, you got to get that figured out. And so one thing I got clear was, okay, if I'm working on a book or I'm working on a big article, I can't interact. I got to go. Because I need, like, the sanctity of my own brain. I can't have people in my head. Mm-hmm. You know, I need to be alone. And so I think, like, these periods are good. You know, I'm at this place now. I used to tell these kids, don't tweet. But I think that's simplistic and wrong. The world is changing, mm-hmm. and it's changed. You need to figure out how to operate in that world. Like, that's the actual question. Like, how do you deal with it? I mean, if the tool is complete junk and doesn't work for you all, that's one thing. But I think, like, you just got to figure out how to operate. So part of that is me just, you know, arriving, okay, when I'm doing X, Y, and Z, I can't have this conversation. Mm-hmm. You know, I got to be... So, like, when I was working on We Were Ages and Pops for, like, 5 months, I just was like, I'm gone. I'm not talking to y'all. You know, but once it's done, you know what I mean, I feel a little better about that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. One thing that leaps out from the book and the collection, you say this over and over again, and it's funny because you're such a... I find you to be a sunny person. I wouldn't say you're an optimist, but you're generally in good
tell
spirits.
Tell them, Jenna, tell them.
Yeah. Like, you're fun to be around.
Right, tell them.
But, but you know, there is this kind of Zen-ness to the collection and the book, and this almost Buddhist radical acceptance of just, this is the way things are. And I think that's a really hard, like, people look to you for answers. They want solutions. We're Americans. We like solutions. Yeah. We want an app for that, you know? We want there to be a really easy illumination to the exit door or whatever, something better. But you say over and over again, you know, I'm not really here to offer that. You know, there's a part where you're like, I don't believe that white supremacy will be resolved in my life or my son's life or
is
his
that
children's
how it sounds?
Life. Yes. And you're like, what do you do and we'll never achieve racial equality or justice in our lifetimes? And you go, oddly, this doesn't depress me. And I'm like, what? Like, reading this, like, how? How? You know, and I don't know. I mean, I think that's what I want to talk to you about a little bit, because I think there is something really beautiful in that acceptance. But you're not saying don't fight.
No,
you're saying the resistance. I mean, this is from the book, I'm paraphrasing it, but the resistance is the reward.
That's
and
right.
We can't forget that. We may not get the results we want in our lifetime, right. But the struggle
right.
is still worth
right.
struggling for, and the resistance is the reward.
Look at you, look at that.
I'm just paraphrasing you. But how do you reconcile that?
I don't know, man. I people always think I'm being extreme when I say this, but for me it's the most clarifying thing. Every human life ends badly. Nobody wants to die. No, but it's true. It's actually true. And you guys are laughing because you don't realize how much we have actually accepted this. Like, we accept this, and we, because you have to, because it's death, you have to accept it. We accept this, and the decision we make as human beings is, but it matters what happens in between. Mm-hmm. It, like, we believe that. We believe that, you know, just because the fact that I can't ward off death does not mean I should go eat a whole apple pie today. Even if I feel like, well, from time to time I might do that, but generally we accept that that's no way to live. Mm-hmm. You know, we accept that. We want, like, certain things. What I'm saying is what's in between actually matters. Blow that up to, like, a historic question. I always tell these people, like, the people in general, not these people. I tell people in general, listen, Europe struggled with the problem of anti-Semitism for about 2,000 years before it got to the Holocaust. 2,000 years. America's young. You understand what I'm saying? Like, and so if America, you know, struggles with this for another 300 years, what is that? You know, according to the long scale of time. African Americans in this country were enslaved for 250 years. They've only been free for 150. It's not been that long. When you think about the other sort of existential problems that this country faces, can somebody really... And I mean this, look me in the face and say, you know what? We are on the path to getting global warming and the problems with the environment figured out. I think we're gonna win. I mean, seriously, like not in a, you know, a kind of, like actually look at the actual record and say, yes, we're gonna beat this thing. I don't think you can. I don't think you can. Human beings fail to figure out big existential problems all the time. This is just one of them. So understanding that, understanding the limits and the fact that in general, people with power, and forget if you're talking about a majority of people with power, don't generally just hand over that power out of a, you know, a moral conviction. That's not actually the history. The people talk about the civil rights movement like that. That's not actually what happened. You know, it's not that, you know, white people in the 60s were somehow more moral. They had external threats like the Cold War. It took 700,000 people dying for African Americans to actually, you know, not, you know, labor under enslavement anymore in this country. It's not moral conviction that moves. So how you gonna live then? Mm-hmm. And that's the question, how you gonna live? So who are you? Who do you wanna be? And for me, that's easy, man. Listen, I take great pride in coming in from this long tradition of people. From the moment we got here in 1619, if only because of the position we were in, who were among that number who did not want the world to tip over the ledge. Mm-hmm. I like that. It makes me feel good about myself. It makes me sunny, as you said. That's where I wanna live. It fills my life with meaning. Mm-hmm. Do you understand? Like I talk in the book about, you know, and I'm, baby, if you see this, I'm sorry for putting you on blast, but I talk about like my wife, Kingad, who was working, you know, for years, you know, as an editor in Mag. And then, you know, like she would work these volunteer jobs. And always it was something, you know, dealing with, you know, women's health. And the last one she really, really worked before she made the switch was she was working as this, a volunteer at Harlem Hospital, which was up the street from us. And she would get these calls at like 2 a.m. when a woman had been beat up by her spouse, and she would go up there and she would have to intercede and let this woman know what her rights were, all the things she had access. You couldn't trust the police to do this, and all the things she had access to. And I would worry like hell about her. And one day I said, listen, you should consider, like, you clearly, this clearly means something to you. It gives your life meaning. Maybe that should be your life. Like, that should be your, you know what I mean? Like, that's the thing right there. It's right actually in front of you. And she's been on this, like, med school path, and it's hard, it's brutal. But it makes you feel like you're worth something, like you're doing something. And I think that should not be dismissed. I think the road should not be dismissed in favor of, yes, but are we gonna win? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know what I mean? What if you're not gonna win? Do you have the courage then to confront how you're gonna live? Do you have the courage to do that? What if I told you you're not gonna win? Mm-hmm. You know, I just think that's important.
I like that. Okay, we're gonna take a couple questions from the audience. Okay, this is an interesting one that I'm gonna read.
Uh-oh.
It says, thank you for whoever submitted this question. How can I effectively use my white privilege to ally myself with and advocate for the rights, the human rights and equality of black people in our nation? Oof. And I picked this because I feel like this is sort of a, like a cliche thing to ask in some ways, but it is actually there is a real question right now about how should a good white person be that I think is worth actually talking about and like entangling with. So I'm putting that on you.
I mean, that's so tough. I think the first thing you gotta do is figure out what you love. Like, what is innate to you? In other words, I think it should start internally and not externally. And then you have to figure out how you angle the thing you love towards the struggle you actually care about. Listen, I love writing. I love all sorts of writing. You know, I read comic books that are completely apolitical, have nothing to do with, you know, any sort of, you know, real, I mean, they're political, but they're not, you know, on their face. I read, you know, writing novels, essays that don't have anything to do with the things I care about. And I love them from the perspective of what they do and the form and my desire to do it. But I angled that love towards the thing that, the struggle I cared about. It would do no good, for instance, for me to tell you, you know what, and this is real, you know what, there are a lot of problems in terms of voting laws in the South right now. You should go down there and work. Maybe you don't care about the law. You know what I mean? So it's the arena that you actually care about and figuring out how you, you know, align that with the fight. And I guarantee you there is no arena where this is not a fight. Not one. Not one. It's everywhere. It's everywhere. You know, so that's the thing. I would actually ask you to ask yourself, you know what I mean? What is the thing you care about? And then, you know, figure out how you're going to, you know, connect that to the struggle you're trying to deal with.
I like this question because it says it's from your niece, Tai Coates.
Oh, John must have sent this up. Okay. Because I don't think she's here.
It says, can you elaborate on why Trump would not be president if not for Obama? I know you've, yeah.
It's not that he would not be president if not for Obama. He would not be president if not for the reaction to Obama. Mm-hmm. And you got to clarify the difference. Because Obama ain't do nothing. Except to, you know, try to be as respectable as possible to, you know, the country. I mean, to present himself in a kind of way that he didn't embarrass himself or embarrass the office or anything like that. And folks couldn't take it. They lost their mind. And I think, you know, here's the birth certificate right here. It says it. Not a small minority of people. Half to most of the Republican Party was like, nah, I don't believe it. I don't believe it. It's still, yo, it's going on right now. It's going on right now. This dude, Roy Moore in Alabama, 14-year-old girl. Washington Post got 30 sources. 30 sources. And fools are not just like, this didn't happen. They're like, he was single at the time. What? What are you going to do? What? It's normal to hit on a 14-year-old girl. They asked the dude on Hannity, man. Not like, this dude didn't go on Chris Hayes, he was on Hannity, and the dude asked him, and he said, I never did it without talking to somebody's moms first. This dude about to be in the Senate, yo.
Yeah.
I mean, even if he loses, he is at the precipice of being in the Senate. What I'm saying is like, this reaction, this kind of tribalism, which goes across, you know, platforms, you know what I mean, which is, you know, racist, gender, and I know that sounds cliche, but it is. I mean, people want their king. There's a heavy royalist impulse. I don't care what he did. He represents me. I want to hit on a 14-year-old girl. I know what man ain't never felt like hitting on a 14-year-old. That's the feeling. That's the impulse. It's the same with Trump. You know, grab him by the I felt like that. I want to do that. Yeah, I'm damn right I'm voting for him. He speaks what's in my heart. And the sad part is, when people vote, you see who they are. You see who they are. They're telling you. And there is a notion in America that undergirds our politics, that the people are right. The people are pure. The people are good. And because the country has defined itself a certain way, that means white people. It can't be that these folks actually have dark impulses. I would act them out at the voting booth. If it is, it's got to be a small minority. I mean, I just, you know, you watch when Hillary Clinton made that deplorable comment, right? And you look at how the press jumped all over her. This is the same press that before was jumping all over her for not being honest or you're hiding something. Now she decides to tell you like it is and you don't like it, and you jump on her for that. I mean, it was, you know, as a reporter, as a journalist, I was embarrassed because she ain't lying, dude. We got the numbers right here. Like, we got the numbers right here. It's clear. X number of percent people think it's fine to ban Muslims from the country. That's fine. I'm okay with that. You know what I mean? X number of people think black people are more, you know, likely to be criminal. I mean, it is insane, but people don't want to face up with that. The fact that a black person, an African-American, was able to secure the presidency against those sort of, and you know, as my dad said at the time, it was because the country was really messed up. I mean, they said, okay, we'll give him a chance. Because don't think he could have won 10 years before. Don't think he could have come after Bill Clinton and won, for instance. Don't think that. I mean, folks were desperate. He was a superior candidate, and he won. And as soon as he got into the office, you get these Tea Party people. You get these people talking about Obama is white slavery. You get birtherism. You get the whole slate of things that a lot of black people knew was coming anyway. So it ain't him. It's the reaction. Mm-hmm. It's the need to see even the worst of you represented in the highest offices. And that's what we got right now.
Mm-hmm. We're at the end of our time, but I did want to ask you really quickly.
These
this wasn't
answers
questions.
I gave. I'm sorry.
Why are you sorry? It was great.
Could have got like, more questions.
No, no, stop. This was amazing. But there was a quick question, and I mean, I'll just ask it because I'm curious, and maybe people want to know too. But what is your next project? Like, what are you working on next before we go?
I don't want to say, Jenna.
What?
Oh, well, immediate next. I guess I got to go back. I got these comic book scripts I got to turn in.
Say that. Yeah. There you go.
Yeah. All right. There we go.
Oh, that's all you want to leave it at that? It's okay if
okay,
you do.
Right. I have a new project. it's a comic book that has not been announced that is going to make, I just can't wait. And now you're going to see the horrible part of me.
Yeah.
Because the entire right wing of the internet, their heads are going to explode, and I'm just going. It's horrible. No, you shouldn't clap. It's not good. It's not good. But I'm going to be on Twitter that day just to laugh and watch when it's announced. All right, I'm not going to say anything else. I've said too much.
Well, thank you, Ta-Nehisi, and thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
So good.
Thank you.
That was Ta-Nehisi Coates in conversation with Jenna Wortham at Wordstock, Portland's Book Festival in 2017. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. Find these and more at colehaan.com. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the Literary Arts staff, board, and community. This show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.